welcome to the War Studies podcast. We bring you world-leading research from the School of Security Studies at King's College London, the largest community of scholars in the world dedicated to the study of all aspects of security, defence and international relations. We aim to explore the complex realm of conflict because the study of war is fundamental to understanding the world we live in and the world we want to live in.
In view, context was framed as a sign of stability. So when the community can go and access health services in the most challenging humanitarian setting and the deepest part of the conflict, they feel that this is a sign of stability and the key indicator and encouragement that the country can move from humanitarian to development in a more prompt and a more steady manner.
In this episode, we explore the importance of women's leadership in healthcare and peacebuilding. Our researchers dive into the complex social and cultural barriers that women face in accessing leadership roles, discuss the vital qualities that women can bring to healthcare in areas of armed conflict, and examine just why women leaders are such a key component of bringing about peace.
In 2021, the United Nations theme for International Women's Day was Women's Leadership, Achieving an Equal Future in a COVID-19 World. The UN honoured the contribution of women humanitarian aid workers who provide life-saving support to millions of people caught in crises in some of the world's most dangerous places. It is estimated that over 40% of the 500,000 humanitarian workers who provide frontline care during emergencies, wars, and disasters are women. Women are also increasingly at the forefront of improving health for conflict-affected populations and have made important contributions to strengthening health systems, improving evidence and humanitarian interventions, as well as in documenting human rights abuses, highlighting the detrimental health outcomes of marginalized groups, and bringing vital knowledge and intervention gaps to global attention. At the same time, women are disproportionately affected by armed conflict and humanitarian emergencies. Yet the importance of women leaders in conflict and humanitarian health has been given little or no attention. Women remain vastly underrepresented in leadership positions within health systems globally, as well as in peace building. In northwest Syria, an area under opposition control, a female candidate applying for a leadership role on the health board of directors was unsuccessful on the basis of not fulfilling a set criteria developed to purposefully exclude women applicants. Similar barriers are faced regularly by women across the globe, where women are frequently found to be overwhelmingly excluded from decision-making spaces. Where gender issues intersect with other disadvantaged groups, for example, individuals restricted by poverty or living in rural areas with limited opportunities to access education, women are often further marginalized. The inclusion of women in leadership positions in health and conflict may well support the aims of global gender equality, which is worryingly becoming more challenging to achieve. The drivers of conflicts are often health-related, and health can be a goal to help competing groups to unite for peace. Yet this aspect remains unexplored, lacking an evidence base to support implementation at the policy level. Through our research, we argue that the missing piece in this puzzle is through women's leadership in health and conflict-affected settings.
Hello and welcome to the War Studies podcast. My name is Ellie Bignall, and I'm a communications officer in the School of Security Studies. Today, we're very excited to welcome a team of four researchers who are tackling global gender inequalities with their research into women in health and leadership. Kristen Meager is a Research for Health Systems Strengthening in Northwest Syria manager at King's College London and is also a PhD candidate in the School of Security Studies, exploring the role of women's leadership in health systems in Northwest Syria. Kristen also co-leads the Women Leaders in Health and Conflict Initiative. Sally Huffus is an experienced researcher and global health specialist who's worked extensively on the intersectionality between health, gender, and protection. She specialises in contextualising and designing evidence based on public health and policies in low and middle income settings from research to implementation. Mariana Jodo works in humanitarian settings and in research related to sexual and reproductive health and maternal, newborn and child health. Muna Khaiti is a Syrian activist, feminist and healthcare professional. She works on global health research that links health to conflict, gender, humanities and colonialism. Together, they have recently researched and published a policy brief entitled An Untapped Potential, Women's Leadership in Health in Conflict and Peacebuilding.
So Kristen, Sally, Mariana and Muna, welcome to the podcast. We're really glad that you could join us today. And this is such an important topic to talk about, especially with women remaining vastly underrepresented in global health and peacebuilding leadership positions, as you mentioned before. So your recent study, An Untapped Potential, Women's Leadership in Health and Conflict and Peacebuilding, really clearly shows a strong relationship between women's leadership, health and peacebuilding in conflict settings. One of the things that you've highlighted in this is that the Women, Peace and Security agenda really needs a significant increase of engagement within health and health systems, especially since it's so clear that existing inequalities are exacerbated and amplified during times of conflict. So how does armed conflict sort of adjust effectiveness or necessity for women's leadership?
Our study found that there is an evident link between the health, gender and peace building in conflict and post-conflict states, and that was framed across different countries differently. For example, in few contexts, such as Afghanistan, Yemen, Libya, and Iraq, it was framed as a sign of stability. So when the community can go and access services, health services, in the most challenging humanitarian setting and the deepest part of the conflict, they feel that this is a sign of stability, even and the key indicator and encouragement that the country can move from humanitarian to development in a more prompt and a more steady manner. Other countries perceived the nexus between health, gender, and peace building from a human right-based perspective or from a human right lens, and that enabled more stronger right-based language and how health is a right for everyone. We were also quite surprised by how in humanitarian settings, wars and conflicts were not only perceived as a barrier, but also they were perceived as an opportunity. So that frames it as an opportunity, basically, to incorporate new changes to health systems when the moment allows for rebuilding these health systems. For example, in Syria, the conflict enforced a lot of pre-existing inequalities as a key barrier and also included a lot of restrictions of movement, a lot of restrictions on women access to education and leadership and engagement in health systems and decision making. But across different contexts, such as Somalia, the conflict helped and facilitated women movement and women engagement in rebuilding and building resilient health systems. So the more women took more leadership roles in coordinating humanitarian response and coordinating health services, and that allowed for more opportunity and opportunity window for their engagement in rebuilding.
So I think a lot of what we're seeing is there's a significant amount of research of what's happening in post-conflict settings. However, a lot of these inequalities are happening before that, before the conflict even begins. So we really need to understand a lot better what is happening during the conflict and those opportunities that have been mentioned throughout and what war and conflict and revolution sort of sparks in people to create change and what change is needed. So we know that conflict promotes conditions during which these gender inequalities are amplified. We see, you know, community structures and family structures which are completely altered, access to healthcare, other essential services, human rights, all compromised. Previous public health emergencies have also shown that the impact of an epidemic on sexual and reproductive health often goes unrecognized because the effects are often not the direct result of public health emergency, for example, but instead are the indirect consequences of strained health and, of course, redirected resources. So perhaps there's something in this as well within a conflict that, you know, we are missing women to perhaps have a better understanding of these resources.
We found in our research that women also adapt certain coping mechanisms to continue their work on the front line. And I think focusing on this aspect is very important and can be used in all post-conflict, like constructions. And it was also fascinating when we always hear that women cannot work together, women don't support each other. But we found different evidence. We found that women supported each other, not just within the certain context, across contexts. Like, for example, one of the research participants, she's in South America, she's tried to link and connect women from different contexts together to share their experience, to share their perspectives. So I think also we need to focus on the bright side of the collective work that women also do during conflict and how they are basically resist all these system of operations I think this is also extremely important to women leadership as change agents, not just as victims of a conflict.
Amazing. So thank you all so much. It's really interesting to hear different perspectives about the different roles and the different aspects to consider when it comes to women in healthcare and leadership and conflict areas particularly. So that brings me on to my next question. Your research has demonstrated that health can be a really significant entry point to women's leadership in other areas as well, such as, for example, navigating political differences or fragmented lines of control in complex conflict. There's also been considerable research done that shows just how gender equality actually speeds up the rate of positive change in achieving, for example, the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And there's also the recent Health for Peace Programme framework that was adopted by the World Health Organization, which calls for the role of healthcare workers to extend preservation and promotion of peace. Yet your research has shown that policymakers in conflict settings often don't consider peace when they're developing or implementing interventions and health policies. Can you tell us a bit more about the intersection of health and peace building and why women leaders are particularly effective in this space?
There is lots of evidence that link health to gender or peace building to gender, but there is no like any qualitative research that's trying to understand this link between gender or women leadership and peace building and health. And we are trying to present this evidence-based research. So we found a link between the three elements. And for example, in the Syrian context, doctors and healthcare workers are extremely respectable in their communities. And people, basically, they mistrust any political bodies. But unfortunately, in all medical NGOs in Syria, there is underrepresentation of women leadership. And we are missing like half of the society here. For us, it's very important to include women voices and also to advocate as research, to advocate for the necessity of increased women leadership in certain, in all like conflict contexts.
Building on what Mona has been mentioning, our study found two really interesting points. So the first one is that there was a division in the language used in gender and in among the healthcare workers and people who are working in gender and protection. And that kind of gap limited this interaction between the two spheres. Another point is how there was very limited programming in gender equality and women engagement in the health sector. And they were perceived as they should be addressing gender inequalities in humanitarian settings were mainly focused on addressing gender-based violence. So moving away from women as victims to women as change agents and women as leaders, that was, I think, one of the most important conceptual shifts that this study elaborates on and identifies. Our also study had the opportunity to examine and unpack a little bit what we mean by leadership and would women fit in the traditional and classic narrative of leaders. For example, when we ask people and different healthcare workers and decision makers what a leader looks like, they are less likely to be a woman with specific characteristics, and they are among even these women, they are less likely to be non-doctors. When we also try to investigate and unpack a little bit the different leadership style and how this can contribute to effective health system management and also strengthening the intersectionality of peace building and conflicts, we found that more women leaders and health systems can support more inclusive decision making and improved health service provision at the policy level, but also at the service delivery level. Many of the participants acknowledged the special leadership style, particularly with key regional leadership trends, for example, in the Middle East, in Yemen, and in Iraq, and in Syria. Women leadership style was perceived to be flexible, accommodating, and inclusive more than the men that they were quite keening towards leadership style that would take more decisions with consulting limited actors rather than the process led by women that usually showed higher level of consensus and higher level of inclusivity.
I think something that's really important and crucial when we talk about women's leadership, bridging health and peace, is that we're talking also about changing the power structures and the power dynamics. And that is particularly crucial in a conflict setting. Yeah. Of course, you know, I'm working obviously in the Syrian context. And so we really see these clear divided lines. So sort of having another way, another approach to sort of, you know, cross these lines could be through women's leadership in health. And, you know, it sounds great in theory, and perhaps in practice, it really will be able to bridge that gap as well. We don't know enough yet, and we're not actively doing anything about it yet, but I hope that this research can actually sort of start that momentum and get people thinking differently. And I am seeing some of that, because we're starting to talk about it. You know, some of the audiences that I speak in front of about this research, I have not been exposed to it before, and these new ideas, but are starting to, come around to see that, okay, maybe there is some other opportunities here. Maybe there's something that we haven't done it before. So why can't we sort of link women's leadership with peace and health and see what we get from that?
Yeah, I think because when I was in Turkey, I always heard this, we don't have well-qualified Syrian women to lead the humanitarian response. So providing this evidence that there is certain barriers that need to be taken into consideration when we are talking about leadership, we need to understand why we have this misunderstanding about women leadership. And I think this is a great potential that is going to reflect on like policy and practice within medical NGOs or within like health system in general. So we are starting to like trying to dig in like little by little. And I think this is a great opportunity.
Amazing. So that actually brings me on really perfectly to my next question. You've touched on some of the narratives or perspectives that women are often perceived as poor decision makers. And there are often attitudes which preclude women from entering certain leadership spheres. What can be done about that? And why does that narrative exist?
One of the key points is the gender division of labor and roles and what is expected of a leader. So, for example, if we look at the health systems, we will find that women historically have been responsible for sexual and reproductive health, maternal health, community health work. And even when they take more leadership positions, they are usually in one of these areas. In a position that has more of a maternal nature, for example, in Afghanistan, we've been examining also the number of women leaders in surgical and general hospitals, and they are zero. There is not a single woman in Afghanistan who's a manager or a higher level for a general hospital. However, there are a couple of managers and leaders for maternity hospital that is much more widely accepted by the community. It's also important to highlight that some of the deeply rooted systematic and structural barriers contribute to this perception about women. For example, some may perceive them as they have less time, or they have more domestic commitments, or they would have maternity leave, and that would kind of represent a gap in their career and a gap in their leadership. It's also important to highlight here the role of few policies in different organizations and workplaces that were not very encouraging of gender equality, particularly in conflict and post-conflict states. For example, we found a huge disparity between the women leaders that we talked to who work in international organizations and their peers who work in national health systems and national organizations. So those who work for international organizations and UN organizations said that they were perceived as good leaders. They found the working environment to be more empowering, and they found that they are trusted to take decisions, particularly political decisions. Most of the women who worked in international organizations said that they received in-depth orientation and in-depth policy briefing about sexual harassment, about protection, about zero discrimination. So they were really emphasizing on the importance of the working culture and the policies behind working culture as an empowering environment, which were not really the case in other local health system organizations. Also, one really important thing about that is the social norms and patriarchy and the role of women and other members of the family, and sometimes perception of religion as well, and culture barriers.
I just wanted to add one very brief thing. From my observations of conducting interviews and focus groups, I think that this role or this narrative around women's poor decision-making or leadership skills exists as a poor excuse to uphold the patriarchy. We see plenty of very capable women leading, particularly at the community level as well, and we need to elevate those women as well to create these role models and this mentorship so that other women can see, I could do that. I could do those sorts of things. Yeah. I did have a brief quote, which I thought was quite funny as well. One individual stated that it's really ignorant behavior. They, men, are just refusing to be controlled by a woman. I don't know why they would refuse, since their wives are controlling them at home. So I think, you know, building on that as well, it's this control and this sort of outward looking control of resources.
In general, mentorship, I think, came as a very important theme when we asked also women and men as well what would help having more gender equitable workforce and leaders in the health sector. And they were usually mentioning the role of a supportive manager and also the role of mentorship. So someone would, in their organization, would offer them how they can build their capacities, how can they gain more trust, what kind of knowledge that they should seek, and help them plan for that. Planning for this kind of knowledge and acquiring knowledge in a humanitarian setting is very, very challenging because everyone is really drowning into day-to-day work. And it can be very, very hard to even stop and ask that kind of question, where do I see myself in 5 years? That kind of question is very rarely asked by women.
I think this is all really vital, really important, and it hits home to so many different audiences as well. There are so many different groups of people affected by this in different ways, and it's really great to encompass all of those different voices and perspectives. So we know that women are disproportionately affected, as you've mentioned, by conflict and by humanitarian emergencies. And your research has also highlighted that most of the funding in this area does actually focus on women as victims of violence in conflict settings, with only limited funding at the intersection of women's leadership, health and peace. What can we do to reframe this, to change funding streams so that they are focusing on representation of women in leadership roles globally, or not just focusing on women as victims?
Providing this kind of research is going to give donors all the evidence and data they need. And also keep advocating and support women networking and alliance and to push forward to change this kind of mentality regarding funding women leadership initiative.
And include men as well.
Yeah, of course.
We have to include men and bring them into the conversation and hear their opinions as well on this and how we can all sort of meet in the middle somewhere.
Also, this nexus that we are worked on, it's going to be important also to tackle climate change, to link health system and peace building to climate change with women leadership. So I think it's also like an idea for the future, for at least for our team. So working with women research also was extremely important for all of us to work collectively and to have this evidence about what women basically are facing on the on conflict area.
Which absolutely beautifully supports the point that you were making earlier about how women support women. And it's really important to have those networks building of support in order to affect real change.
So we're now going to move on to the feature section of the podcast. This is where we look at the researchers behind the research.
So what brought you all into the areas of studying women, peace building, health and conflict?
I've been working for the last 12 years in humanitarian context across Yemen, Iraq, Bangladesh and Myanmar and Djibouti and different countries. And in many of these occasions, I would end up as the only woman in the room. And I feel that many of my colleagues were feel a little challenged by my presence. Yeah, sometimes I ended up being excluded from specific moments of decision-making, being excluded from decisions. So when I found this opportunity to that this is the first time to structurally and in an academic setting to study this intersectionality between women leadership, health and peace building. That was a moment of realization. I mean, yes, please, we need to do that. This is an, we really would like to understand why this is the case and if this is my only problem for me only, or this is a more of a structural problem everywhere and for many people of similar background as myself.
For me, I've been working in a humanitarian setting for the past 6 years with an international NGO. And the last couple of years with like an increasing personal interest about this topic, I started actually to reflect a bit on when we're on the field. And then this opportunity arrived to work on the topic, and it was, yeah, perfect, because actually now it made me reflect a lot more about my field experiences and look at it with a gender lens, which was not happening before. So, and think about how can this be changed while working in field.
So before working at King's, I was working with forced migrants. And when I started working in research, I wasn't really sure necessarily how that could really translate into policy and actionable policy, and how I could advocate for people that were affected by conflict. And this has been an amazing opportunity to not only advance, you know, a group of people whose voices are often not heard because they are affected by conflict, but also by women, and that I could relate to those women as well, and that the, you know, the struggles that they were facing were struggles that we were all facing as well. Of course, there are differences, and being able to sort of learn from that and all work together has been an incredible experience.
I consider myself as a political activist and also healthcare provider. So I worked in Syria on the ground during the conflict. And basically, I have faced the similar situation Sally faced. And I was extremely aggressive there because I need to fight always for my like right and other women rights. Basically, working on the ground is quite tough for women, because especially if you are local. And after I left Syria, I worked, I led this initiative for survivor group, because I witnessed many of war crimes and be subjected to those crimes. So I think linking and learning from other women who basically we are interviewing, always fascinating how women like basically are coping. And it's give me hope that this injustice is gonna change. I think we always feel this amazed by how women who have like limited access to all resources trying to find their own solution that can fit into their culture and community. So it's always, doing research, it's always fascinating. Talking to people, especially women, always fascinating. We have this like also common interest in talking to women on the ground and learn from them. So it has been an interesting journey so far.
I think that's one of the things I enjoy the most about research, is even if you're not an expert in that area, you get to go out and learn more from people that are experts on the ground, and you know, put their voices on paper. And I always say I'm sort of constantly thinking of, you know, the woman that I get to speak to, and I feel very privileged to be able to speak to those women, and I can hear them when I'm sort of talking, and hope that we can get that across.
And I think it's also a woman characteristic that we always say that we don't know everything. We are learning. Well, we don't hesitate to ask for information and learn. I think it's very important to focus on women in academia, and also encourage women to pursue this career, because honestly, no one gonna do this research if we didn't do it.
Yeah.
I think it's very clear how passionate you all are about it. And it's really lovely to see all the different backgrounds. Is, you know, you've talked about how having a different a mix of voices is so important, and you really have that here, which is really special. And I'm sure it's had a really beneficial effect on your research. So moving on to the next question, what are some of the highlights of your fieldwork or the research that you've done so far?
My highlight of this study was working with an amazing team of researchers. And I know that this may sound as cliche, but getting to work, for example, with Mona, who's a researcher with a lived experience, and obviously, as she was just mentioning, how far she has been in the middle of the health system action, including decision-making, perception of leadership, perception of different social and gender norms, and how they restrict not only her, but the different health actors, and how far this excellent combination of our team experience contributed to in-depth interpretation of the findings. So we didn't really look at the data just from a data perspective, but we also had a lot of reflections from our team because they really lived either a similar situation or they can relate to many of these incidents. So I think that for me was really fascinating experience. So thanks a lot.
I'm always trying to advocate for mental health because working on the ground and in humanitarian setting, it's always going to be affect your mental health. And there is no like proper funding to proper mental health program. There is no such intersectional approach to mental health because it's not just about being like in this conflict area. Basically, women are fighting patriarchy, fighting the social norm, and also are victims or survivor of that conflict. So for me, I was always pushing. We didn't ask about mental health, but it came up during conversation. And I was always, we need to include it. And I felt that my voice and my own experience also affect how we see the data. And it is because it's extremely neglected area in research. Mental health during conflict, it's completely neglected. So I feel also blessed that we have this harmony to work together and to also support each other, even in like hidden way. It was great for me.
My first highlight was, of course, working with all of you. Again, I know that does sound cliche, but it was very much an equal playing field. We all sort of came to the table with different ideas. You know, I know I had sort of put this funding proposal together and then I needed the input from everybody to really get this going, and we all worked really well together on that. So that was really exciting. I think conducting interviews and focus groups is always fascinating. I think when you're in an interview, particularly talking about this topic, you sort of start to scratch a little bit at the surface and you sort of hear, oh, yeah, there's some issues around, you know, a lack of gender equality and a lack of women's leadership. It's not so bad. And then as you sort of start to ask more questions, you sort of dig a bit deeper and then you see really how bad it is in these situations. I think also conducting focus groups, particularly with men and women, was amazing. Mm-hmm. Watching how vocal people got over this topic was, yeah, really eye-opening. I sort of just sat back and listened and just absorbed all of that information and really learned from that. So that was a really big highlight for me.
For me, I'd say linking with that, it was actually the opportunity, as you said, to speak with women and pushing them to think about this issue, because a lot of it was like, oh, actually, yeah, for some of the things, it was felt like it was the first time they were given the opportunity to think about it and to say it out loud. And it just really highlighted the importance of continuing to do that and doing it more, way more often and systematically across the organization to actually create a space to reflect on the gender, how is the gender mainstreaming being applied in the field. And this linking with what Muna was highlighting on mental health supports, that this came at some of the interviews, the way that mental health support could help to deconstruct some preconceived narratives and ideas of people, and how can this translate into organizational culture, and then how can it affect the rest. So
what advice would you give to young people who are looking to start their careers in this area?
Maybe the best way is for them to explore their own journey and their own set of beliefs to drive this journey. But I think two things that I wish people have told me, so I would really keep in my mind when I was starting my career in this area, is I think the biggest challenge is to make this balance between using evidence and using human rights-based approach. So most of the time, we're really driven by how we want to deliver the thing that has the most effectiveness or efficacy, but not necessarily this is the most human rights-based or equitable approach to do things. So I think this is an advice I wish people have told me when I started my career, and it's worth really thinking of and reminding ourselves, are we really taking the right decision? Are we really maintaining the right balance? So yeah, I think that's something that I would recommend people to look at more.
I think it's also they need to keep in mind to have this critical thinking about all situations you're going to find themselves in. It's always ethical dilemma. It's, there is no black and white. And sometimes you will have to take like bad decisions for the greater good. And also be aware for their mental health, because no one prepare anyone for like seeing what they are going to see on the ground. And I think knowing that it's going to affect you because you want to make a change, to use your resource and your power to help people to regain their own power. We need to normalize that it's okay, but you need to ask help.
Constantly sort of question yourself and your thoughts and beliefs, and learn and listen. Listening is really crucial, because there's a wealth of people that know a lot more than you do. And even though that's quite hard, you know, if you want to advance in a certain sector, you need to amplify your own skills and abilities, but actually listening and learning is one of those as well. And we can constantly learn from people.
We are able to unlearn, not just learn, unlearn, to raise our like knowledge in some area and ask people to give us their knowledge, because we don't have the same experience that they have. So it's also it's extremely important.
I'd say that now this became a topic that is increasingly becoming a priority, and that you can use that in your favor to actually push for further advances in field. So I think it's a good momentum to start a career on this.
Also for young women, if we didn't fight for this, who is going to fight for our rights? And also, we are privileged enough to be in academia. So it's also good use of our privileges to impact policies and to try to make change. It's collective change. We need to work together to have this as women. So I hope that more women are going to pursue this kind of work.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we aim to do with our podcast is highlight research projects that we're involved with, so that hopefully that will inspire young people to carry on, as you say, advancing that research, using that momentum that you guys are already building.
Well, thank you all so much for appearing on the podcast today, and for a really fascinating discussion and an overview of such a pressing global topic. You've been listening to the War Studies podcast, produced and edited by Lizzie Ellen, Lauren Midgley and Ellie Bignall from the School of Security Studies at King's College London. For more information on our work and to sign up to receive regular updates, please visit our website, which you'll find in the podcast description. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review us on your preferred podcast provider. It really helps us reach more listeners. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on the War Studies podcast.